Welcome to episode 447 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, we have a Q&A episode in store for you, and I'm joined by Tobias Haumann, or Toby Haumann, who is one of our exceptional scientific triathlon coaches, and he will join here to co-host and help answer your questions. As a quick reminder, we do these Q&A episodes regularly, although not on a specific regular schedule. So anytime you want, you can send in any questions that you have that you want us to answer in detail on the podcast to my email, michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And no matter when you send in the question, I always store it and then consider it, and hopefully I can answer it on one of the next Q&A episodes. Before we get into the Q&A here, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. Whether it's a caffeine gel before a sprint triathlon to give you an extra boost, or a full-on carbohydrate and electrolyte strategy required for an Ironman, getting your fueling and hydration right can be the difference between achieving or not achieving your goal. And Precision Fuel and Hydration have products that make it as simple as it can be to get your fueling and hydration right. You can easily fine-tune your intakes to your carbohydrate, sodium, and caffeine requirements, ensuring that you get the most out of yourself on race day. Their gels, drink mixes, and chews are easy to digest, making them a reliable choice for any endurance athlete. And you can get a free fuel and hydration plan for your next race with the Fuel and Hydration Planner on Precision Fuel and Hydration's website. As a TTS listener, you can also get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into today's Q&A with Coach Toby Haumann. So I'm here with Toby. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Toby. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It's your first appearance on the show. And for listeners that may not have seen your name, you are one of the scientific triathlon coaches. It's your first appearance here. So yeah, welcome once again. Can you just, because it's your first appearance, tell the listeners a bit more about who you are and your background in triathlon and so on?
Yeah, sure. Well, my name is Toby. I'm living in Germany, south of Munich, near the Alps, in a beautiful city called Rosenheim. I'm living here with my beautiful wife and our little Sue here. In regards of triathlon, I've been short course triathlete by myself, major starting in the first German Bundesliga, and also was a long distance athlete, but not a very successful one, to say it like this. I started coaching 15 years ago. Since then, I worked with everything from age group athletes to pro athletes, and let's say latest also with para athletes for the Paris Olympic Games. And last but not least, I am the newest add-on to the scientific triathlon coaching rooster. I think the first German guy. So very proud of this. Yep. And yeah, I think enough from my side.
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. We have to, since you mentioned working with para athletes, you had some good success in the Paralympics in Paris. Tell us how that went.
Yeah, my athlete had success. Let's say for me as a coach, all I can do is do the programming. In the end, it's the athlete who goes the way and pushes through the race. But yeah, my athlete actually won the bronze medal in the triathlon, which was a very proud moment and very nice end to a 2-year long hard journey.
Nice. So let's not waste any more time on an introduction, and let's get into the questions that we have for today's Q&A. So the first one is from Alex, who writes, I observed that in training plans, when prescribing quantifiable metrics, we round things. Taper can be a multiple of weeks instead of 13 days. Session durations increase in 10 to 15 minute increments. Rest between swim intervals are round numbers instead of, for example, 26.9% of your CSS. Do you think that there is a round number bias when prescribing plans? If yes, what do you think that the impact of it is? Would it make sense to prescribe dimensions as multiples of something individual to the athlete, for example, critical swim speed, time to exhaustion, etc.? And beyond round numbers, why not prescribe training with intuitive descriptions like rest until breathing is restored, do repeats until you feel like there are only three left in the tank, etc.? What are your thoughts?
Interesting question. First of all, I think in terms of why do we have round numbers, from my perspective, you shouldn't make training too simple, but you shouldn't also make it too complicated, which means if we would not work with round numbers, or let's say numbers that are easy to do, we would make the whole training process more complicated. Secondly, for example, with the swimming, coming back to the swimming example, usually swimming has a tradition, and a lot of swimmers are swimming with the world famous swim clock, which is basically working in 60 seconds and with four little, let's say, watch signs, basically. And round numbers work there in a better way, because it's whole seconds and it's easy to see increments of 5 seconds, even if you're blind like I am. So it's quite easy then. Secondly, why don't we split it up in certain ways? And this is, from my perspective, a thing when it comes to what is important in terms of the training session. And for me, to be honest, the total, let's say, the length of the workload is, or the workout is not that important. It's rather the total workload of the session that creates an effective stimulus for the training. And to be honest, I simply don't care that much if we want to have a certain workload, if we do this in 3, 4, or 5 intervals. There are certain softs that you can do if you want to create specificity, that you create longer intervals or something like this. But to be honest, I don't care that much if we are working with 6 minutes, 5 minutes, or 4 minutes, if I want to have a workload of, let's say, 30 minutes in the session. And for me, the whole numbers are easier to work for the athletes, because they can simply measure them, yeah, on their watches, for example. And in terms of the work-rest relationship, I think it's a fair point to put this in, because we know there is some individual factor in terms of how an athlete recover. If a athlete is more endurance dominant or is more speed dominant, this can definitely have an impact on the rest, and prescribing something individual can indeed maybe improve the training session. Nevertheless, we also know if we want to have a certain outcome of the training, a certain, let's say, there is a certain demand, what is a good rest. Just to give you an example, if we work on a lactate threshold 2 session or something, you will usually go with a rest of 1/3 to 1/4 of the workout. And of course, this works easier if you are working with whole numbers, again, because it's easier to work for the athlete. So basically, the rounding up of numbers has for me nothing to do with, let's say, being not accurate, but more about making the training process as easy as possible for the athlete.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And yeah, with the swimming example of a CSS of 140, I know that in the question, the 26.9% is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment, but then it would be impossible to have a 26.9-second rest. Like, how do you actually execute a session like that? So why not make it 30 seconds in that case? And as you say, there are definitely individualizations you make. So somebody who is doing maybe a set of 15 or 20 100s, but they're doing them in 2 minutes, their rest is probably going to be longer than somebody who is doing them in 1 minute or 1 minute 10, just because the work-to-rest ratio ends up being a bit more similar. But still, within that work-to-rest ratio, let's say you do it in 2 minutes, yeah, maybe you take 30 seconds rest, because then you get roughly a 4-to-1 work rest ratio in that example. So, but yeah, I think it's to make it easy. I got a bit of a flashback to, I'm a pretty big Harry Potter fan, and you know the money that they use in Harry Potter? So yeah. They have one galleon, and then they have the sickles that are, and I think there's something like 13 sickles to one galleon, and then there's 29, is it knots to a sickle? So it's like comparing that kind of system to having 100 cents to a euro. It's just, that monetary system in Harry Potter is complicated because it's funny, but it's not made like that because it's effective or anything. So I think it's the same thing. Like there are certain ranges that you maybe try to work with in terms of whatever you're trying to do. I also agree with, it's more about the total work, not about how long the intervals are. And I'm even more so, I think that rest intervals, I'm even less interested in, to be honest, because I think that if you do the total work that you need to do and you do it with quality, then the rest can be almost whatever, except in certain sessions. But in many, like when you're doing more like LT1 to LT2 work, I think that the rest doesn't really matter that much. So yeah, it is to make it simple. For that reason also, one example is I know a lot of athletes use percentage of FTP for their bike session. So then you might end up with a session that tells you to do between 217 to 238 watts or something like that. And I would never, as a coach, maybe I have a bit of an idea of a percentage and I use that as a baseline, but then I would always actually round that and not write those numbers in the session and not even use those percentages, not write anything about percentages. I would just prescribe the session as 215 to 240 watts in that example, to give, because to the nearest five, in terms of watts, people can, to the nearest 5 seconds, 10 seconds, people can work with easily. And it just becomes so much more practical and less cognitively demanding, less energy consuming during the session.
And also one thing we never have to forget is that, let's say the athlete changes from day to day. And so do the, let's say, certain training zones, diversion, have different zones per day, let's say. So if we give them bigger ranges and give them more round ranges, we also encourage them to have more wiggle room to work into this, which improves the training process because it prevents frustration in the session, because you can have a very good night of sleep and you had a wonderful breakfast, then you can basically maybe push the 98% of your 300 watt FTP. But if you had a bad session, a bad night of sleep, and you nevertheless want to have the session because you have no other chance to get it in this week, maybe the 280 is more suitable for the session. Nevertheless, the effect of the session for the body, considering the stress that we have currently on the body, is the same.
Yeah, yeah. I think one other note that I took here for this question is that where I think there is a potential problem with a bias is not in terms of round numbers, but in terms of fitting everything into a week. Because, of course, we also have this construct of a week, which is 7 days. That's how our society works generally. And it can be quite easy to fall into the trap of trying to fit maybe too many things into a 7-day cycle. I do think that for most people that have normal jobs, it makes sense to work in a 7-day cycle because mm-hmm. when everything else is set to that rhythm, it's hard to make training fit into a completely different rhythm. If it's somebody's job, then I think that there are other cycles that can work equally well or better. But when somebody has a normal day job, then if that day job is also on a 7-day rhythm, then I think it makes sense. But maybe the problem there is that sometimes it's easy to try to fit too much into 7 days. So you try to get your long run and your threshold and your VO2 max and maybe in three different disciplines and so on. So that's where I think there is a bit of a maybe, or the bias that we have, natural bias towards a 7-day cycle, can cause some problems if we're not attentive to that. So that, what do you think about that?
Absolutely, absolutely agree. If we, let's say the 7-day cycle is more like something we have to do out of necessity, because if we work with working athletes, it's most likely they won't just have the time on the weekends, or maybe they have no time on the weekend, which could also happen because they say, okay, I can train under the week, but the weekend should be reserved for the family. And this is something that is absolutely understandable and we have to consider as coaches. But to be honest, coming back to people whose job is sport, I also tend to work with 10-day cycles, no issues ever, because they are not dependent on a weekend. And because then I expect them that they fit training into their life because sport is their life. And even in the high performance world, even 3-day, 4-day cycles can be suitable. Only just to, because let's say the total workload that these athletes are under is so high and sometimes so unpredictable in terms of the effect that we see after putting in the workloads, that we have to work in such very short cycles, let's say. But I agree, the 7-day cycle is sometimes, it's great to build some structure, and it's great to keep the structure, but it can be also limiting if you try to fit too much into the week. And this is sometimes you try to fit too much intensity in the week because you think you have to, let's say, have this 2 intensity sessions in every sport, and then suddenly you're missing out the time to develop your aerobic system here.
Yeah. The final point that I made here is about the suggestion to use intuitive training descriptions, like that example of rest until your breathing is restored and so on. So I think that there is definitely a lot of potential use cases for that sort of prescription. I do generally encourage athletes in most interval sessions to use a 1 to 2 reps left in the tank philosophy. So if they get to whatever interval it is and they feel like I only have 1 more in the tank, even if they maybe have 2 more or 3 more in the prescription, then stop it when you still have 1 more left in the tank and don't go all the way to the well. So that's one example of using those sorts of intuitive prescriptions. But yeah, you could also do it with things like the rest intervals or any number of things to bring some more autonomy on the athlete's part, self-regulation, which can in many cases be the most effective way of getting the best training execution on the day when you have some good cues, good guidelines for that self-regulation. So yeah, there are a number of different examples that you could use, but I think that there's definitely room maybe for even more of those sorts of intuitive descriptions, at least in the typical training plan, let's say, which is perhaps a little bit strict and rigid. And so I do agree that there's maybe more room for those intuitive descriptions and prescriptions.
Yeah, I like, to be honest, I like this a lot, especially intuitive descriptions in rest intervals. I mean, which does not mean that I don't prescribe the duration of the rest intervals. But for example, what I like, especially in the running field a lot, is I have them, for example, something like, okay, you have an endurance rest period. And for example, if we train something like tempo changes, this can have a really nice effect on the athlete because you leave more room for the athlete to show what feels easy already for him. So you can see a lot of progress in such sessions if you give them enough freedom to also say, okay, you are just running easy afterwards, whatever easy feels on the day, and you can see how strong of aerobic development your athlete sometimes already has because he can tolerate, let's say, a rest at, just putting out the numbers, at 4 minutes per K, and he runs his marathon pace efforts in 3:30, then you suddenly see, okay, oh, the aerobic fitness is there. But if he if he needs, okay, if you say, okay, you have an easy rest or an endurance rest and he maybe still runs 5 minutes, okay, you see, okay, we are still not there where we might want to end before the competition. And let's say being not so strict in terms of specific intensity or even duration can be very helpful for the process sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I think that that's probably quite enough for that question. So let's move on to question number two, which is from Sean, who writes, what are the main benefits of doing anaerobic, so way beyond LT2/VT2 intervals? Does the body adaptations to this effort really pay off the stress and effort done, or not that much, and it's better to do efforts at or a little above LT2/VT2? Okay, so just let me clarify that for the listeners, because I didn't read it very well. Basically, the question is if it's worth the trade-off to do intervals that are significantly harder than the second threshold, or is the stress and the cost of those sorts of efforts such that it's not worth it and it's more effective to basically keep the training at or a little above that second threshold? That's basically the question.
Yeah, again, very, very interesting question. But let's say from a coach perspective, we have to look at it in a more nuanced way. Because what we label as anaerobic training actually includes different kind of trainings. Yeah. So we can lay under anaerobic training, we can label the so-called alactic anaerobic training, which means that you're basically using energy from phosphates, mainly ATP and creatine phosphate. Typical training for something like this is a sprint or strength training. That's typical alactic training. Yeah? The other anaerobic training is lactic anaerobic training, which means we are working in the so-called anaerobic glycolysis, which means we have no oxygen left in order to meet our energy demands. So our body basically breaks down glucose in order to formate lactic acid. A very nice effect, I think most of us athletes know. That's the burning in the muscles. And being
although I would say that it's not, I wouldn't say that it's correct that we don't, we always use oxygen, except if it's a very short sprint. But it's more what is the predominant energy system and how strongly activated is the glycolytic system.
Correct. And then depending what we want to develop, let's say this, both systems inside the anaerobic system have their place in a training process, from my perspective. For example, alactic efforts, first of all, they are great to work on the muscular coordination and also for technique elements and also in order to develop raw speed, which is a skill that is important for every endurance athlete, I would argue. The second, the lactic anaerobic system has also its place. Let's say how much of this training is needed, from my perspective, is basically demanded by the event demands, because it's depending on the event you're doing. This can be a relevant training, or this can be a training that is nearly irrelevant for the success in the event. Usually the longer we go in endurance events, from my perspective, if we talk about triathlon, cycling is a little bit different because of the race demands that we have here. But if we look at triathlon, the longer we go, the less important for me is the lactic anaerobic system for race success. Nevertheless, from my perspective in the development of the athlete. It has its place because it teaches the body to build up lactic acid and to also work with the lactic acid. And secondly, for example, a training we, or at least I, like to include in order to develop a very broad aerobic range are VO2 max intervals. And VO2 max intervals per se are anaerobic training, which we know has an effect on the development of the aerobic system, which is the predominant system that we need for success in triathlon.
I think the thing for me is that the term anaerobic and the term aerobic, they are terrible terms for me that we should probably remove from the lexicon. Because I mean they are based on I don't know exactly when they came up in the exercise science physiology world, but they are decades old, if not a century old, terms that were basically founded on whatever knowledge existed back then about how physiology works, and that has developed now. So we know that things are not, that it's not a question of whether you're aerobic or anaerobic. There's a combination of both oxidative processes and glycolytic, and potentially even the phosphocreatine type processes ongoing at the same time at all times. And it's just a question of how much of each. I like to, if we talk about sport like running, for example, I would always use terms like marathon pace, half marathon pace, 10K pace, 5K pace, 3,000 meter pace, mile pace, 800, 400 pace, all out sprint, basically. So you never really need to worry about the physiology. It's more of a performance demand, but you can then obviously you get to the physiology through those actual outputs that you're targeting. But the other thing here is that, or a clear demonstration of how these terms are really poorly used is that in the question Jaume asks about intervals, yeah, being significantly above the second threshold as being anaerobic. But as you said, Toby, that could also include VO2 max intervals, which they are called VO2 max intervals because they are really good at developing VO2 max, which is the maximum aerobic capacity. So basically, I think that I have treated the question as, yeah, any interval that is like not around threshold, but anything from VO2 max intervals, let's call it basically 5K pace and above in running terms, or maybe it's 3K pace and above in running terms, that we're talking about intervals in this range. And yeah, I agree with you that there are reasons to include potentially all of these types of intervals right now. Some of my athletes have already finished their 24 season, had a bit of a break, and are now getting back and doing 25 meter sprints in the pool, hill sprints, 10, 15, 20 second hill sprints running, sprints on the bike, 10, 20 second sprints. And I think that there are huge benefits to that. And it also sets up, I actually think that one underappreciated benefit of the kind of really, let's say, shorter duration intervals, anything up to 30 seconds potentially, is that when you really develop that glycolytic capacity, I think that then helps you execute better intervals in the 2 to 3 minute range, because you use, with that additional glycolytic capacity, you can better stay around your VO2 max or close to your VO2 max for longer in a session. So I kind of like to use it in the very early phases of getting back into base training, basically, and then potentially doing some VO2 max training a bit later on with anything from short intervals with short rests to something like 2 minute intervals with 2 minute rests, or 4 minute intervals with 4 minute rests, that sort of thing. So I think there is definitely benefit for all of these, but it's about the periodization, I think. For me, that's the crux of the question. When do you use what type of intervals?
Absolutely, absolutely. And like I said, they are, depending on the event, they can be more or less important towards the event. Nevertheless, we should not only think about this intervals as a way to develop our metabolic system, let's call it that way, but it's also a great way to develop our muscular system. We should never forget that we no person on the world has 100% slow twitching fibers in their muscles and or 100% fast twitching fibers. And of course, we know that they are this in-between fibers. And I feel in order to develop a well-rounded athlete, and for me, that's always the goal. I want to have a well-rounded athlete, even if we get more specific towards the event. But for me, for creation of a well-rounded athlete, I need to work on all skills. And especially the speed skill and the anaerobic skill is a skill that a good endurance athlete needs to develop and needs to work on, because it helps in the total process, even if it may not be that important towards the event.
I completely agree with that. I think that's something that a lot of athletes could, basically it could be an easy improvement for a lot of athletes to try to become more well-rounded athletes. And I think maybe, I don't know, this may be just speculation, but I think a lot of athletes may look at, well, what are the pros doing? And it always seems like they're doing Ironman pace or half, like 71.3 pace, like maybe some threshold intervals, that sort of thing. And then they kind of copied that, but then they miss the fact that most of these professional athletes have been doing some kind of sport, not necessarily triathlon, but some kind of sport since they were 5, 7, 10 years old, and maybe they were swimmers and they were doing massive amounts of just pure skill work with sprinting and that sort of thing, or they were runners and they were doing sprints on the track and they just have that skill and also that well-roundedness deeply ingrained already in their background, and the refinement at this point in their career is more to just work on the endurance and durability and things. So that's why it's, yeah, maybe they're doing predominantly those longer, more, yeah, but yeah, longer efforts that are more race specific. That said, you could argue that, yeah, there will still be a lot of benefit. And maybe the reason is also that you don't see all of the work that goes on in the off season far from races. So again, a question of periodization. But I do think that there's a bit of a trend towards, yeah, too much race specificity and not focusing enough on being a well-rounded athlete, because being a well-rounded athlete will benefit you no matter, it will raise your ceiling across all distances in triathlon or in any endurance sports that you do.
And I would also argue that we don't see this video, this nice sessions on some YouTube videos from very nice locations because they're simply boring.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to see if I had any other notes. Do you have, while I look at that, do you have any other points on this question?
Maybe a small add-on, an effect that anaerobic training can have, and this is relevant for some athletes. It has the potential to increase the basal metabolic rate. And this can be a nice add-on to this training for certain athletes, but it's nothing that might be too important, let's say, in the context of triathlon training, to be honest.
Yeah. I have two more things that I saw in my notes here. So one is that because of Jean's concerns, I guess, that he expresses around the stress on the body, I think that one problem one mistake that people do is that they try to combine high intensity intervals with doing their endurance training too hard, basically in a 5-zone system, always being in zone 2 rather than doing it in zone 1. So I think that when you do the hard intervals really hard, really intensely, then you also might need to adapt your endurance training so the easy training becomes really easy and stick to zone 1. And if you want to talk about zones. And then, so that would be one thing. And one other point, there is maybe one athlete profile where I wouldn't use so much of these high-intensity intervals. And it's when we have somebody coming from, who has a very, already a very kind of explosive profile, very fast twitch profile. And an example might be somebody coming from team sports or from power sports, combat sports, potentially somebody that can easily and potentially already have a high VO2 max. So like a soccer player potentially could have that combination of a high glycolytic capacity and a high VO2 max, but poor endurance, poor durability. And in this case, maybe you don't need to do this so much, at least until you have evened out some of the weaknesses or the gaps for an endurance athlete, like just building your aerobic capacity, your durability, and evening things out a little bit in terms of your strengths and weaknesses for the purposes of triathlon. So that doesn't happen very often, but there are definitely some athletes that were with this profile where I would be maybe a bit more cautious with using these sorts of intervals.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely good and very valid point. What you can do with such athletes, you can include it because it will nevertheless help this athlete also. But what I would always do with an athlete that has such a power profile, let's call it that way, I will include more rest into the intervals in order to give his system more time to recharge again before the next workout. Where sometimes with very high aerobic developed athletes, you can work with really short rest periods here, and they will have a good effect on this. And coming back to your first point, which was maybe for me also the most important point, athletes tend to go too hard in this if they are in a so-called anaerobic training. So intensity control becomes very, very important in this area, just to prevent the athlete to go too hard in the session. Yeah. And sacrificing a lot of rest there for that.
Yeah. Let's move on to question number 3 that we both agreed was perhaps the most challenging question, but a really good question. This one is from Mickey, who asks, my maximum sustainable heart rate seems to be falling during races, but not during training. It could be age-related, but it's almost as if my central governor is restricting me more than before in order to survive and get to the finish line. The positive side is that I'm finishing races stronger, but I am slower overall, and I can't help feeling that I've lost some capacity to suffer.
Yeah, interesting question, honestly. First of all, a great kudos that people are still reading Tim Noakes and his theory of the central governor, which, let's say, is groundbreaking in some extent. Maybe to give a little bit of background, so central governor theory means basically your brain prevents your body from a fatal breakdown. And that's why the brain is down-regulating your body and you are not able to push to the end. Because in the past, it was, let's say before Noakes, it was thought that it's basically a function of building up of lactic acid or something else. But what no one could ever explain is something like a finish sprint, for example, because if this might be the case, then a finish sprint will be something that is impossible. And Noakes, let's say, solved this by introducing the central governor theory, meaning your body saves always, or your brain saves a little bit of energy in terms you have to fight or flight. And basically, but to secure this, it downregulates the systems. Let's say that there has been a lot of work in this field, and it comes to the model of fatigue that we work with. And to be honest, for me personally, I don't follow the central governor theory anymore. I'm more in a theory that is from Samuele Marcora, which is psychobiological model of fatigue, which means it's not only muscle damage, it's not only energy levels, but it's also the brain in a linkage with all the systems that maybe downregulates the effort. And this comes more or less with perception of effort, which means it's not necessarily a thing that is related to energy systems or something. It's how hard you feel that something is. And a nice thing to, let's say, to prove this, yeah, for example, is exercising in very hot conditions, for example. You suddenly perceive the effort as way harder as it is, and your body downregulates. And what the system also explains, if you are very high motivated in certain events, because it's the Olympics or something like that, you can sometimes even exceed your level. That because it basically dissolves the natural borders that your body has. So with the effect in the question, for me, it means maybe he personally perceives the effort as tiring. And that's why his body is basically downregulating the system a little bit.
Yeah, or the reward for the hard effort isn't as big as it used to be.
Exactly. And let's say this can have a multitude of reasons. For example, a good friend of mine said if you feel negative and you get angry in a race, start eating. And we know that, for example, a low sugar level can have this effect of being not motivated. I think everyone knows this effect. And of course, in a race with a long duration, if the sugar levels go down through a level, you will also lose motivation. And of course, then your body downregulates and you will see this in a heart rate. At least this would be my explanation. If, let's say, everything else was done right, let's put it that way.
Yeah, but in this particular case, I think we can assume that he's doing things more or less the same as he has been doing before, but he's no longer able to really access that, let's say, level of, like, not able to reach as high an effort. That's my read on it. And I have to say that I've definitely experienced this in some races. So I kind of, yeah, I definitely get what he's saying. And I think I have a few different theories. I don't know which one is correct, or if any of them is, but there are a few things to consider. One option is that maybe he's just a little bit overcooked, whether that is from training volume or training intensity, or even if training is right, maybe the training life balance is a bit different, the work is a bit more stressful, or just that maybe with age, the need for you maybe need a bit of a longer taper perhaps with age to get the physical and mental freshness to be able to then go to the well on race day. So this is something that could be one possibility, because I think that I've experienced this, that if I'm a bit overcooked, it's impossible to have go to the same level of suffering as you can when you're fresh. So for at least for some people, I think that is the case. Another option is to consider the type of intensity you're doing in your training. And this is a little bit what we discussed in the previous question, that if you get stuck into doing a bit too much just race specificity, thresholdy stuff, and just always being in that kind of moderate, heavy domain, so moderate intensities between the first and second thresholds, I think that can almost change your physiology in the way that you find it really hard to access higher gears and efforts on race day. So it can change your physiology, but it can also change your psychology, because you maybe don't get the same level of suffering in those sessions with longer intervals as you get in those sessions with shorter intervals. But then on race day, even though it's a continuous long effort, having experienced that level of suffering that you get from shorter intervals, I actually think can be quite useful, because it's a more intense suffering rather than just grinding it out. So that's another one, that maybe mixing it up with intensity can be helpful, even if it's just from a psychological perspective. And the other option that I'm thinking about is
if this is something that is more related to your racing psychology or your racing mindset. So is there a specific reason that perhaps you are just really afraid to blow up? For example, maybe you had some race in the past where you blew up and it left some psychological scars. Or it might be that if you're only racing let's say two races a year, but they are really big races, like a big 71.3 and a big Ironman, and they mean a lot to you, then that's also maybe going to put a lot of pressure on those days. And it might mean that you have more fear of failure than feeling that opportunity to have a big success, to have a great day. And that fear of failure can drive that you're not really able to go as hard as you should. That is essentially, your, in some ways, your brain is protecting you or preventing you from accessing the higher intensities. So there, I think if that is the case, then just do a few more low-key races, and also maybe going down in distance if you're doing always longer events, to just try to go as hard as you can in a sprint distance race. Just throw caution to the wind and go out there and smash it, maybe without a power meter, without GPS watch, just see what you can do, and practice your racing mindset and in a low-key environment, in a no-pressure environment. So yeah, those are some options that I had. Does any of that ring a bell for you, Toby?
For me, to be honest, there are a lot of good points. But if I look at the question, what I don't fully understand, how can you finish stronger but be slower? And for me, this also means not the best understanding in terms of pacing. I think blowing up is not fun at all and should be prevented at all the time. But to be honest, if your pacing is too conservative, it will also prevent to have a good result. And for me, if an athlete has a lot of pacing training and knows what paces he can go, then for sure he will finish strong but exhausted in the end, because he will exactly judge how much he has left in the tank and can push. And also, in together with motivation to finish a race fast, which is deep down in all our minds, I guess, then there should be enough ammunition in your brain in order to push yourself to the finish line, from my perspective. So for me, it looks like you said, either you are totally overcooked and just want to get the race to be over, but you are not searching for the best result possible anymore. Or it's for me also to question your pacing strategy a little bit. Because if your pacing strategy was correct, then you should be motivated in the end to push, because you have the energy and you want to show the best possible self on race day.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually had this exact situation where coming off the bike, I felt bad, but bad physically, but also bad in terms of not being able to push myself to suffer, and they are maybe connected. But then in the last third or the last quarter of the run, the finish starts to get closer, and somehow I'm able to speed up quite a bit and actually finish strong. So I've had this happen a couple of times at least, where I do a slight negative split, but a negative split in a longer triathlon, that's not that common, I would say, for most people. So I've had that happen several times, and it's always been where I feel like the beginning of the run, not actually feeling good, but also not feeling psychologically that I am able to push. I want to push myself, I want to suffer, but I'm not able to for some reason. So I absolutely can relate to that feeling. And it's not a question of pacing, because you're for some reason not able to push yourself harder than that. You're going as hard as it feels that you can, But then when you get closer to the finish, you're able to find a little bit extra. And that's maybe where the central governor model can, it's maybe not the most complete model, but it can explain that sort of situation a bit. So, and for me, again, what I've, in the analysis that I've done after those sorts of events has always been something related to one of those things that I explained in the previous points, that that's usually where things have gone wrong, not in terms of the pacing. Potentially it could be also bike nutrition or hydration issue, if you maybe under fuel or under hydrate on the bike, but then you manage to kind of get on top of that on the run and you start to get the effect towards the end of the run. But that's not that common, to be honest. But the other thing, because he mentions that his heart rate is lower during races, but not during training, maybe race without the heart rate data, because it might be that you're kind of seeing heart rate get to that level that right now feels like your maximum at during a race. And then that also psychologically means that you think that you are at your maximum, but actually you're not. So maybe race without the heart rate data. It might be subconsciously holding you back. That's another thing that I would say.
Yeah. And I mean that the heart rate gets lower at longer races. It's an effect that is not that unusual, to be honest, with the onset of fatigue over the race.
Yeah. But I'm not aware about
the effect, basically, what is the reason behind this. To be honest, this is something you have to ask someone who is more into the physiology of the whole thing, but it's an effect I observe quite often.
But usually it is because you're slowing down, and it wouldn't get lower if you're maintaining the same speed normally. But I think when he says that his heart rate is getting lower, it's not that it's getting lower during the race, but it's compared to 1 year ago or 2 years ago, his average heart rate and maximum heart rate during the races is lower now than it used to be. That's my interpretation. Not that it's getting...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's maybe move on and tackle the final question, which is from Mattia, who asks, I have a Garmin Forerunner 255 that measures running power without needing any additional equipment. The issue is that these values don't correspond to my level as a runner. My PB on a 5 kilometer duathlon, so not entirely maximal effort, is 19 minutes, 23 seconds. It was 451 watts at 75 kilograms, so 6 watts per kg. My PB on a half marathon is 1 hour, 31 minutes at 406 watts and 73 kilograms, so 5.5 watts per kg. By studying data from other runners with 6 watts per kg for 20 minutes, I should be running much farther than 5 kilometers. For example, Cesare Maestri, Italian trail running champion with 6 watts per kg, ran 10 kilometers in 30 minutes. I'm wondering if it's a systematic error with my Garmin or if I have very poor running efficiency and I waste a lot of energy with each stride. Could you help me answer this question? Have you ever encountered someone with a similar issue?
Yeah, I think we can answer this question very easy. Throw away your Garmin and buy a more expensive Garmin because it will definitely be better. No, honestly, it's what's in running power. It's a difficult discussion. And to be honest, to have a short take on this, don't believe these numbers. I think, let's say you can measure running power. That is possible. But usually what you need in order to measure accurate running power is way more that you have in a Garmin watch, because it's basically related to high speed multi-camera analysis, ground reaction force data, force plates, instrumented treadmills. Then you have an accurate value and you can really say, okay, this athlete needs that much watts in order to run that speed. That's, at least for my knowledge, the only accurate way to measure this. Now, let's look at the tools that are out there that are basically claiming they can measure running power. And for me, this is, of course, every sport watch these days. And not, am I allowed to name it, but a stride sensor, which is out there. And yeah, let's say that's the tools that are out there. Nevertheless, all these tools are basically using an algorithm in order to estimate the potential power that you're putting in, which does not mean your power is in any way comparable to athlete A or athlete B. It comes more to how reliable and repeatable are the numbers that your specific measurement tool is measuring. And a study in this regard I can recommend is by a Spanish research group, and it's called Are We Ready to Measure Running Power?
I have that in my notes as well, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. It's really good. It's really good, and it's a really well thought study that also measures VO2 while running, and it compares the repeatability and the validity of, I think it was 5 commercial technologies. I think Garmin was there, and Stride was there, and a few others. To be honest,
RunScribe and Polar, yeah. I think
exactly, and. Basically, to summarize this, they showed that the Stride seems to be the only one who delivers repeatable and valid results, which nevertheless now also does not mean you can compare the power output you are putting out against the power output of an athlete. That still doesn't work. Maybe to tell how I use the Stride with athletes, because we are using it. We are using it not for pacing. We are using it as Mattia already wrote, we are using it to measure economy, because for certain paces, we can see what wattage the athlete is basically putting in, or what Stride is stating that we are putting out. And this is especially very interesting if we are comparing super shoes. Here, to be honest, a Stride pod can give real good insights in terms of with which shoe an athlete is more economic. But other than that, in order to let's say guide the training process or what else, we are not really using it, to be honest. It's more like a secondary data, something like heart rate. But for example, for running, I don't use it to steer the training process at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would do almost the opposite. not that I would steer the training process, but I think that I don't use it, but I have had it, and I just lost mine on a trail somewhere and didn't bother buying a new one. But anyway, I think that as a pacing tool, it can be really useful when you know your typical numbers. So for example, when you run uphill, yeah, maybe you want to run a bit stronger uphill, but you can still see that you stay within a certain range. You learn to use it as a pacing tool on things like hills and into headwinds if you have the wind version. I'm skeptical about the efficiency use of it, to be honest, because I've seen some athletes, even depending on which foot, if it's on the right foot or the left foot, it changes the numbers if you're running on a track. So it just seems too sensitive to certain changes, and I'm not sure that I don't trust it enough. But we'll talk about this more, because I'm curious to hear later on how you use it. I'm just not trusting enough in the sensitivity to pick up changes. I just think that maybe the power numbers are a bit too much related to the actual speed you're running. So it's not a true efficiency or economy value. It's definitely not a true economy value, but not even a true efficiency value that you're getting. But yeah, other than that, I definitely think that you're spot on that you cannot compare between different devices, between different people. And one interesting thing to mention is that in that study that you mentioned, so they compared to oxygen uptake, and the stride is very well correlated to oxygen uptake, stride power, which shows that it's a good proxy for your metabolic power, essentially. Like how hot is your engine running? And Stride has a white paper where they describe, they don't say it straight out, which I find weird, but they strongly imply that they intend Stride to be measuring metabolic power and rather than mechanical power. Mechanical power being how much force are you actually putting into the ground for kinetic and potential energy. But Stride thinks that, well, actually the better use is to be a proxy for metabolic power, because that is how you actually pace races and so on. That's basically what their white paper is saying. I'll link to that so people that are interested can read. Garmin, on the other hand, on their website say explicitly that their power is supposed to be, they say, I have it in my notes somewhere, it is mechanical power. They say propulsive power applied to the road by considering the major components of work done during running. But obviously that is impossible to measure when you just have a watch on your wrist. So no matter what your algorithm is. And I think it's interesting also to note for the listeners that when we talk about cycling power, we don't have proprietary algorithms. Cycling power is torque times angular velocity, and every power meter, at least pedal and crank-based power meters, work that way. With running power, every manufacturer has their own black box that we don't know exactly what it is. So it just tells you, and as we've seen, Stride aims to be a metabolic power meter, and Garmin aims to be a mechanical power meter. So it's just apples and oranges, and we don't even know exactly how things are being measured. So I think that there is still a use case for power meters, and for me, it would be more pacing, but yeah, maybe there is a case for efficiency measurements. However, the numbers are not reliable for comparing across different people and say that you are less efficient or more efficient than another runner based on their power numbers.
Let's say pacing, I tried this and I did not like it, to be honest. And I also felt it wasn't following the power numbers wasn't the best strategy for this hilly course, to be honest. Even adapting it to a certain level, I would have run it in another way. And in terms of maybe to come back to how I use it, usually we have with the athlete, we have a clear definition on which food this pod is. And also, if an athlete uses this, they have also to note down, and we at Scientific, we're using a well-known training platform. They even have to note down the shoe they are using, because for sure, this has an impact. Yeah. Nevertheless, in terms of metabolic power output, absolutely true. And that's indeed what the thing is measuring. And that's also why I don't use it for pacing. Because usually if I'm rested in a race, the numbers don't add up for me again. And that's if I would steer the training process in a more metabolic way. And let's say there is a world famous coach here in my area who is doing this in some extent and isn't using these numbers in order to make metabolic profiles in terms of total metabolic output per day, per week, and so on. Then it's in some extent valid. But to be honest, again, I would use it as a very nice tool and not steering the training with it, and even would not pace with it. And also a little caveat here, from my perspective, we are currently drowning in data, especially from this famous watch manufacturer. if I look at the data that I get on a daily basis, I'm very curious how they measure it, because some of the data, to be honest, can only be measured in a lab environment. So it's a nice estimate. It's something nice to play with. It's like the nice race prediction or the recovery score or whatever. I think it keeps athletes aware of certain things, and that's a very positive thing. But to be honest, if athletes rely on this data, it becomes difficult. And this is where, from my perspective, we as a coach have to steer the attention to the data that does matter for the athlete, and addition by deduction.
Yeah, 100%. And also, I think building anti-fragility into an athlete, the more variables you have in your training process, that then the less anti-fragile you become. And that's something to avoid. But yeah, I think that basically that sums everything up. Any other thoughts on any of these questions that we have missed?
I think not.
Good. Yeah. No, I think we covered everything. And for this question, so as I said, I will put some links in the show notes, the study and the Stride white paper. The Stride white paper is actually a really good read for people that are interested in these things, and to get a bit of an overview of how they view running power, but also just it is validated by external, not validated, but it has been written in collaboration with external researchers that know what they're talking about in terms of the physics and the physiology of running. I'm not saying that the Stride people don't do, but it's not just an internal piece. It was a collaborative paper that I find a good read. But yeah, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Toby. And people can find more information about you on scientifictriathlon.com under the coaches tab. So check that out if you're interested to learn more about Toby's coaching. And speak to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael. Have a good day.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And for the last question we tackled, the one on running power, we have a few links in the show notes and episode description as well. So as I mentioned, I believe Garmin's definition of running power, as well as Stride's white paper on running power, and the publication Are We Ready to Measure Running Power by Espejo and colleagues. So you can find all of those links in the show notes or in the episode description. Now I have time for a little bit of a promotion of some of the things that we do here at Scientific Triathlon, and one of the highlights of that is for sure our training camps. No matter where the camp is, the goal is always that you will come away from it a fitter athlete, maybe a more skilled athlete, especially considering we usually do a swim video analysis and also a decent amount of descending on the bike. And finally, that you come away a more fulfilled athlete by getting to have one of the most enjoyable training weeks of your life in a great group of like-minded people. If we bring that back to something that we talked about many times on this podcast, the biopsychosocial model of performance, being a fulfilled athlete and enjoying your training also contributes to driving fitness adaptations. So it's so-called double whammy when you think about it. And next year, if you are interested in this, we will have two training camps. We will be in Mallorca from the 5th to the 12th of April and in the Algarve, Portugal from the 26th of April to the 3rd of May. And you can find all the details of both camps on scientifictriathlon.com under the training camps menu. If you read about these camps and you're not quite sure which one is right for you, the best thing to do is to email me and we can discuss that based on your particular preferences. But rest assured that no matter which one you choose, you will have a fantastic experience and get a great week of training in a beautiful location as well. Just to give you a bit of a teaser for what you can expect if you decide to join our camps, here is a review that we got from one participant for the Mallorca camp. This one is from Stefano, who writes, "The amount of training experience available was incredible. So many intriguing and fun sessions. Plus, I really enjoyed the detailed workshops and the Q&A session. On top of this, it was truly amazing to have all coaches readily available to answer questions and give feedback. The facilities were great and the hotel landscape is so relaxing. And all participants were so energetic and full of desire to share thoughts and personal experiences." So if this piqued your interest, check out the details on our website, and I also will have links directly in the episode description. And then you can register in the form on the training camp page for each respective camp, or you can contact me directly via email, michael@scientifictriathlon.com, if you have questions or need any help. I'm very excited to meet you and get to know you on one of our camps in 2025. Now, finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose from, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.